think we have enough criticism. We have enough critics in this town. We have the professional critics who work in the city, and then we have this venue for everyone, to be a critic. And I said, what if we took this whole notion of being a food writer or a food critic and kind of turned it on end?
Hey, hey, hey! Welcome back to another episode of Cream City Dreams. We are your hosts, Megan Schultz
and Shelley Roeder. And on this podcast, we interview dreamy Milwaukee women. And today, holy buckets, do we have a great story.
Really fun. Today, we're interviewing Lori Frederick of On Milwaukee, food writer. I would say, well, initially, when we had her on, I was thinking food critic, but actually, she is not a food critic. And we will hear why in this episode. So cool.
Yeah, I love that part. Yeah. And now author. She's got a beautiful book about Wisconsin food and farms, stories of farmers and their resilience. You know, I love a good resilient farmer.
Yes, you do, Shelley.
That's really cool. She talks about that.
And where her food comes from. So cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's let her tell us more. Settle up at the table and enjoy this episode.
Gwen Provecho.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, we're super excited.
Well, I didn't necessarily expect that when I had a chance meeting.
Yeah. Well, let me start by explaining that chance meeting, because that's how you're on this podcast, Lori. We're super excited to have you. So we saw each other at, or I saw you, I should say. You had no idea who I was, but I saw you at the Boone and Crockett. Is that area called something different, or is that just the picnic tables outside of Boone and Crockett?
Patio. Yeah, let's call it their patio. Yeah.
Yeah. With the taco truck and the other
Doobie Dogs.
Yeah.
I was doing a feature because they just introduced a new hot dog truck.
Yes. Yeah. So my husband and I were there having dinner before a show, and I saw you across the way, and I was like, I'm pretty sure that's Lori Friedrich, the food writer, but I also think that's Lori Friedrich, who used to work in the dean's office at Marquette. And I used to go to Marquette 10 years or, 12 years ago now. And so I approached you, and I think you were probably like, oh dear, I've been spotted, the food writer. But I was like, no, are you the Marquette Lori? So we have this connection because you did used to work. You weren't always a food writer.
No. I've always pursued food things on the side of anything that I've done. Okay. But for, it was almost 15 years, I worked at Marquette University in their College of Education. So
yes. Yeah. And I don't know if we had many, if any, interactions back then, but I remembered from that.
Yes, and I remembered your maiden name.
Yes. Yeah. So. Basilius. Yep. Yep. Yeah. And so, yeah, so we had this lovely little interaction, and then you sat down because it was a full patio and we had room at our table. So you sat down and you were with your husband. I was with mine. We just had this lovely dinner while you were critiquing or reviewing, I should say, the Doobie Dogs.
Or just eating and taking pictures. Really.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we wanted to just ask you a little bit about your path to becoming a food writer. Are you living the dream? Where did the dream come from? Tell us a little bit about that.
Definitely living the dream. And I say that with hesitation. And not because I don't mean it, but because it brings me back to the moment that there were conversations about me joining On Milwaukee full time in the capacity that I'm working now. And I remember coming out of one of those coffee meetings. And we hadn't, I hadn't signed on yet. But there was definitely intention. They're like, we would love to create a position for you here. And I remember going back to my parked car and kind of dancing around the car thinking, this is crazy and impossible. Food writer jobs are rare, and amazing. And how did this happen?
Yeah.
How did it happen?
Well, and to be honest, it was quite a let me see if I can give you kind of the short version of this, or at least, you know, the non-rambly version. It really was a matter of doing what I loved and watching for what I call doors and windows to open. I had started my career looking for a position that had something to do with writing. You know, I mean, because obviously I didn't get out of college and go, oh, I'm going to be a food writer. In fact, I had no idea that the writing that I would do would be linked with food. But writing was always something that I loved. And cooking and food was always another thing that I loved. I brought those together kind of early on in a food blog that I had called Burp.
Called what?
It was called Burp.
Oh.
Burp. Burp exclamation points.
Awesome.
And there's a story behind that. I had read a fascinating article about traditions in different countries, how people express satisfaction at the end of a meal. And there are a number of countries where letting out a big belch or a burp is like the highest possible compliment you could give to a chef. And my husband and I, like early on in our marriage, you know, when we were both kind of working jobs, like we didn't have a ton of money, but we'd sit around or bottles of wine, you know, and chat about wild things. And, you know, if we ever, what if we started a restaurant? You know, what would we call it? And I laughed and suggested one night, and this is probably ridiculous, that we call it Burp, because we wouldn't want someplace that was too snooty. But we also, you know, we wanted people to feel comfortable there. And I like the idea always of the story behind the story, you know.
Yeah,
and so totally. This idea of burping being flattering and complimentary as opposed to disgusting, as we might see it here in the States, was kind of attractive. And so I ended up with a food blog called Burp did that for years, not really thinking that that was going to be an entryway into other things, but it did way better and got more visibility than I would have ever imagined. I mean, I started blogging back. Do you remember the Julie Julia movie?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I laugh about this. So I started food blogging back when Julie Powell was blogging. And I remember, I mean, we didn't know one another per se, but we were blogging at the same time, and there were no pictures on blogs at that point. It was all about folks writing about their food experiences or sharing recipes and her blog was amazing. I mean, she was a great writer. I would read her blog, you know, we'd exchange comments. And then as time moves on, then it became all about the photography. Mm. And I was like, oh, shoot. like, how do you do this? I don't really know what I'm doing. And I went and bought a digital camera and made that happen. So the blog ended up being successful in ways that I had no idea would be. And it led to some recipe development gigs and ultimately creating recipes, writing about food, different things, freelance work that I was like, oh, this is great. I wonder, you know, maybe this is a direction that I could go. And so one thing led to another, and eventually I got a little bit more well-known in the city of Milwaukee. I started a group called MKE Foodies that was basically like a little social, it was kind of initially just a social group to try to get the food bloggers in the area together. Because I became curious at one point. I'm like, I know there are food bloggers across the nation in big food cities. These are the people whose blogs I read, but I can't be the only person in Wisconsin. God forbid I be the only person in Wisconsin with a food blog, right? So I went on a search, and I would just spend time, you know, I had spare time, and I would just spend time Googling and looking for bloggers that were from Wisconsin. And I started a little blog roll listing them all. And I mean, ultimately, I mean, it started out with like 25 and 50 and 75, you know, and I think at one point there were close to 100 and some food bloggers in Wisconsin, not all of them, you know, close to Milwaukee, but the comments I would hear from people frequently were, oh my gosh, look at this great, like people would point to this wall of, of food blogs. We're like, look at all of us here. We should really get together. And I don't know, because I had time on my hands. I was a doer. I developed a mailing list and said, okay, let's plan some little happy hour style events. And get you all together. And that kind of blew up by itself. People started coming to these events, which initially I would go and I would talk to a restaurant and I would say, hey, I'm bringing, how many people can you accommodate for something like a happy hour? Maybe you can serve a couple of appetizers, you know, for free. People will come by, get drinks, blog about you, tweet about you. And then I would send out a note. Okay, we're 25 people at, you know, Via Pizza. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would sign up and they would show up and folks would, you know, I mean, it was a great little kind of networking / what I now recognize as social media marketing, you know, for the restaurants. And we did that for a long time and it grew so big that people outside were like, I'm not a food blogger, but I love food. Can I come? You know?
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, okay. And then we started partnering with charitable partners and charging a little bit, you know, like $5 or $10 at the door and giving all of that money to a local food related charitable cause. And eventually it got so big that our accountant was like, you guys are giving away all of your money and you either need to become a nonprofit or make more money. Because like you have two choices here. You can make more money so you look legit to the government, or you can become a nonprofit so you look legit to the government. And we're like, okay. And about that time it was like, maybe we're just gonna stop. You know, I mean, this is we didn't really want it to be a business. And we didn't really want to fool around with the nonprofit aspect.
Right.
So we just sort of let it fade away. And I only tell that side of the story because that gave me connections with chefs, mm-hmm. with restaurants, with folks around Milwaukee that were just related to the food world. Ultimately, pardon me, I had a friend of mine sent me a note and she said, hey, Milwaukee Magazine is looking for some folks to write digital content for their new website, you know, because they've been a magazine for years and years, but realized they needed to get online. And she said, you know, they already have Ann Christensen as their food writer, but maybe if you don't cover restaurants, you could write about something food related. I'm pretty sure they would be excited to have you. So I applied for a freelance position with them, basically writing about what I call hidden food gems or hidden gems, you know, in food. So I wrote about like little ethnic grocery stores and small businesses. Because at the time, which is around 2009, 2010, there were lots of small food businesses cropping up around Milwaukee. I wrote about Indulgence Chocolatiers, possibly one of the first, when she was working out of a warehouse in Waukesha, mostly doing chocolate favors for weddings. I just found little things in little niches that nobody was covering and wrote about them.
Yeah.
And they were all like, anything I would be excited about. I figured, well, I can't be the only one. Ultimately, On Milwaukee saw what I was doing for somehow, one reason or another. And I got a tweet from Bobby Tanzillo, who's still with us. And he said, you're doing cool stuff over there. You should come do that for us.
Hmm.
And I think I gave him a little bit of a hard time. I'm like, but why? And he's like, because we've been online since 1998. And we have this huge online audience that you just can't, you know, you just aren't going to get where you're at. And I was like, all right. And we had a few conversations, dickered a little bit about, you know, the minimal salary that I would get as a freelancer switching over. And I switched over to On Milwaukee and ultimately did that. I think I freelanced for about 2 years before they decided that they should really create a full-time job.
Mm. So that would have been sort of 2013, 14, 15, where you've been full-time since then?
Yes. So I went full-time in 2015.
Okay.
And it's maybe interesting and important to note, because a lot of people, I think, you know, when we were talking before, you were like, oh yeah, you're reviewing these hot dogs. And On Milwaukee initially proposed that I come on as a food critic. It was interesting because while I understood the job and felt like I could do that, I wasn't, there was something in my gut that told me that that's not exactly the job that I wanted. So I came on at first doing a little bit of criticism. Don't dig back there. That's probably a little embarrassing. No, but number one, I was definitely recognizable in restaurants because I knew at least some of the restaurants. I knew folks. Mm-hmm. And I think initially they thought maybe I could be anonymous. Maybe I could get away with it. But I was seeing that the world was kind of going in a different direction. You know, critics were... At that point, critics were very, very slowly starting to come out from behind the anonymity in other markets. Mm-hmm. There was also, you know, the more I thought about it, I basically started the job and I said, give me a minute to just kind of think through. I said, I have some ideas of what this role might be. And obviously we have to agree, but let me do a little bit of this work and let it all settle. And then I'm going to come back to you and kind of explain what I think. And when I came back, I realized, you know, as I thought about it, there's Yelp, there's Google, there's Facebook. Everybody can review everything. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. your average person can get online and decide, you know, essentially, I mean, and it's kind of serious that way. It kind of helped decide the fate, you know, of a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, and we have two major food critics. You know, we had Carol Dipciola at that point at the Journal Sentinel, and we had Ann Christensen at Milwaukee Magazine. Mm. And I finally went back to Andy Tarnoff and Bobby, and I said, I think we have enough criticism. We have enough critics in this town. You know, we have the professional critics who work in the city, and then we have this venue for everyone, you know, to be a critic. And I said, what if we took this whole notion of being a food writer or, you know, the food critic and kind of turned it on end. And what if I wrote about all the new stuff? You know, you want to give every new place a chance, right? Mm. But also then, you know, pointed people toward just what's good. I mean, I said, when I look around me and look for recommendations on where to eat, I just want to know what's good. You know, what dishes are good, which restaurants are doing a really good job. I don't necessarily want to see, you know, I don't need what's to see bad. The stuff right. about what's, you know, what's mm-hmm. bad. So I said, that would put me in an interesting position where not only would I be doing something different from what most people around are doing, but I said, I really like the idea of being able to go into the restaurant, into the kitchen, talk to the chef, write different kind of more intimate articles than what you're going to get if that person knows that you're also going to come into their restaurant and put your white gloves on and, you know, feel around on everything.
Yeah. You
know, when you're eating there.
Because nobody at that time, and maybe even to this day, would have known what Carol looked like, right? So you're saying is they knew.
Yeah. Her. I mean, there were some suspicions and there were a couple of people who didn't, you know, that, I mean, you look behind the scenes and you'll find that some chefs had pictures, like someone would find an old picture back in the drag somewhere and put it up, or someone would have taken a picture, be like, oh, this is for sure Carol. So there was a lot of speculation, and I'm not sure that the anonymity was as anonymous as, okay. as folks thought, but nonetheless, I mean, my theory always too with restaurants was that if they did decide that I should be a critic, that the anonymity portion was not going to be the end of the world. It would make it harder to judge service because folks might naturally be inclined to be kinder, more accommodating. But with regard to food, nobody can change it up that fast. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a team working on dishes back. Maybe you can make my plate a slight bit prettier, but that food's going to taste and be executed how it's executed. So from a food standpoint, criticism can definitely exist without anonymity. The service portion, and I don't really know how some of the critics that are public, how they handle that. Because I would say that I definitely, if I go into a place and people know I'm there, which does happen frequently, the service changes. The attentiveness changes, the interest in who you are and who's at your table changes, and usually in a good way.
So service is not one of the things you touch on in your writing. You're more focused on the story behind what's happening in the kitchen, the good food itself, the good where it comes from, all that good stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and when I write about a new restaurant, it's what I would call a feature. You know, I may photograph a bunch of dishes. So I'll talk to you about what they are. In some cases, we'll editorialize if something is like, oh my gosh, so good that you can't, you know, because why keep that from people? But I try not to do too much of it, because ultimately it's like, okay, this place is new. If this looks good to you, go try it, you know, try it out, give them a chance. And then from there, you know, from there I go on and, you know, come out with, like, right now it's dining month at Amalaki, and I have every day I'm releasing a list of must try restaurants in different categories. So today the category is sandwiches. And I basically, you know, I spend my whole year eating or at restaurants. I mean, I have a list of the restaurants I need to keep up with. And I try to get to places at least once or twice a year, every year. Kind of make sure things are still on par. You know, if somebody gets a new chef or it's a new restaurant, you know, it might take a few trips to figure out like where they're at. And then I take notes on what dishes are good, you know, everything that I've eaten. So it makes it a little bit easier when I get to the point. I take pictures of everything. And then when I get to this point, I can curate 5 really great spots to go for sandwiches, you know, and it might not be, it might not be all the good spots to get sandwiches, but it'll at least be, I know these places are solid.
So some might say that this is the dreamiest job ever. And I'm about ready to like, can we stop? I need a sandwich right now. Like, but what are there any realities of this being your work that aren't dreamy? Like, what about this is hard?
It's hard to keep up with everything going on. And I am on Milwaukee, even though it's been around for, you know, 25 years. We just celebrated a 25th anniversary this year, actually. I laugh because in 1998, can you imagine starting a website? I mean, maybe around in 1998, I laugh and jokingly say that the only things that were on the, you know, the internet was full of lies and porn in 1998. I mean, there were news. There weren't news sites, you know, there's nothing. I credit on Milwaukee with being very forward thinking. I mean, it was 2 young guys who said, this is the future and we're going to do this and see if we can be the first to do this great. And I think those first few years are probably really hard, but they definitely made it happen. But we're still pretty small. I mean, Milwaukee has stayed pretty small. We have 5 writers, you know, probably there's 15 of us total, you know, with the behind the scenes people and the front of scenes people. So it's, when it comes to food and the dining space, it's me. And, you know, we can sometimes have restaurants opening, you know, multiple restaurants opening at a, you know, in a week. Then there could be like kind of little spurts of slow times. But the reality is everybody has news. And now that I've been doing this for 10 years, people know and trust me and come to me with their news. So it's hard, and it's hard to say no. You know, someone comes to you and they say, hey, we're rolling out a new menu. We think people are going to be really excited about it. Can you come by, you know, take some pictures and write about it? Of course, they're like, I want to do that. And so it's hard to balance when you have, you know, 4 or 5 requests like that, you know, all in a short period of time. Or there's, you know, there's new things that pop up all the time. You never know when public record is going to reflect that there's a new restaurant going in somewhere. So I have to track a lot of records. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff. I have to track a lot of records. I have to stay in touch with a lot of people. I don't have, people trust me to do my job. So I don't necessarily have deadlines. I have to make sure everything is timely. So it's very much, it has all the stresses of a journalism job, you know, but you definitely, I mean, if I were to choose a topic, I would entirely choose food over crime or, protect or anything. So there are days, my mom calls all the time and she's like, oh, honey, you work too much, right? And it's like, well, it's kind of, you know, the job doesn't have regular hours.
Yeah.
It's got sort of random. So
it's got breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
So yes, right? I mean, yeah, you know, but I think that whole idea of do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life is sort of misleading. Mm. Even if you do the job that you've always wanted to do, you know, and you do something that you absolutely love, that you, right now, I always tell people, like, if I had to go do something else, I'm not sure it would be what it would be right now. Because I really do like this a great deal. And it's hard to envision moving away from it. But there's still, you know, there's still days.
Well, and
we're not perfect humans, right? Like, I wake up grouchy some days, and that makes my job harder.
Yeah, or I'm sure there are parts of it that aren't particularly fun, that might be like boring or mundane or just hard to get motivated to do, like any other job.
And, you know, and to be honest, I mean, I have to write up closings, and it's never fun. I feel very connected to the folks in the industry.
Yeah.
I understand how the industry works. I understand how hard it is to make a restaurant go. And so when you get somebody on the phone and they're just, you can always hear, they're devastated. You know, sure. Nobody wants to close their place. Even if they know it is the best possible thing for them, you know, for their mental health, for their family, for whatever. Those are just hard conversations to have. The only good that I see, like, in those is that people will, like, I've made it a point to always let people talk about their closings. You know, like, I don't want to just write up, oh, that place is closed, because I try not to, you know. Okay, there are occasions where it's like, oh, there's a sign in the door, your phone number has been disconnected, you're very obviously closed and no one can get a hold of you. And I've written those stories, but the more I can, I don't know, I feel like closure is nice. And I feel like restaurant owners are, it's respectful to give them closure, you know, and allow them to tell people how they feel about their restaurant, and not just in a Facebook post. So the upside of that is that it does feel good to be able to, you know, to thank people for their years of service, to connect with them at that point in time when it's like, obviously, this is the best decision for you. We're all going to be sad, you know, but thank you for everything that you have done.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and you mentioned this before, and I love in your email tagline, you say eater, writer, and storyteller. And I love that you have eater in your tagline. That's so cool.
But can you imagine being a food writer and not really loving to eat?
No.
I don't know. I mean, I hope there's not one out there, because it just seems so wrong to me. But you never know. You know, never say never.
Yeah. How can you trust a food writer who doesn't eat? No. But storyteller. And you said this before earlier in the interview, like you know, you like to get the story behind the story. And I think that's a lovely segue into listeners. You can't see what I'm holding up, but this is Lori's book that just came out. It's called Wisconsin Field to Fork, Farm Fresh Recipes from the Dairy State. Oh my gosh, this is beautiful. This is the pictures in here are gorgeous. The recipes look amazing. But what's really cool about this book is that before each recipe, there's the story of where the food comes from and the specific farmers that farm the food and get it to the restaurants. And then each recipe comes from one of our local Wisconsin restaurants, and a lot of them from Milwaukee. So a lot of these were like, oh my gosh, I've been here. Oh my gosh. So tell us about this. Let's hear about this book.
So this came about because a friend of mine who is also a writer who has done work for Globe Pequot, the publisher, they said, we are looking for somebody to write a cookbook about Wisconsin. We don't have a cookbook about Wisconsin, and we'd really, you know, we think that it's Wisconsin's time. And she's like, oh, I'm not that person. You know, like, her name is Christine Hansen. And she has written about cheese. She's written about food related things, but she's like, I just don't have the connections in the food space with chefs and folks to write a cookbook like that. And then she said to her editor, but I know someone who might be a good fit. She came and asked me, she's like, well, would you be interested in writing a cookbook? And interestingly, I had just come off of a project that On Milwaukee did in collaboration with Pick and Save during the pandemic, where we published a cookbook of local recipes from area restaurants. And published it in a cookbook that Pick and Save sold. And we used the money to give $25,000 grants to local restaurants to help them to get over the hump, like to recover after the pandemic.
Oh.
So I had done a very similar project. I was like, I kind of know how this works. I kind of know how hard it is to get recipes from folks and photos and things. And we were in this space where I signed this contract for the book in 2021. So we were coming out of the pandemic, but it was still like very much a part of, you know, very much had an impact on restaurants and very much had an impact on the farms. So I have been telling people, like, this was an interesting time to write this book, because the restaurants, while there aren't the stories, you know, you're not going to read the stories in here of where they were at, you know, the restaurants that are in here are restaurants that took the time, you know, and felt like they had the bandwidth to participate in something like this, you know, and get me a recipe and get me. And part of the work on their end was, you know, restaurants cook for, their recipes are 5 or 7 times the amounts, you know, that you would put in a cookbook. So my ask was, please at least, you know, make this into a recipe that feeds like 4 to 6, you know. And then the farms told stories, you know, about what they went through when the restaurants shut down, you know, how much of their business they lost, what they did when there were no farmers markets, you know, during the pandemic. So it's very much, you know, this book very much reflects the times that we were in, which I think makes it really, really interesting, because all it does is underscore how intrepid farmers and restaurants, you know, really, really are. The book was an amazing journey. So they said that they wanted a cookbook about Wisconsin. And as we talked, I said, you know, how much are people still interested in where their food comes from? And the publisher was like, oh, very, very much so. I said, so if we did a cookbook, I've always wanted to see a cookbook where you could see the connections between the restaurants and the farms that they work with. I said, but maybe this is too behind the scenes. You know, I said, because I've been privy to the conversations that chefs have sometimes with farmers who bring them food. I know that years and years ago, farmers used to grow things specifically for chefs. That didn't work out so well. Because sometimes, for instance, a chef would say, oh, would you grow me? I'll take bushels and bushels of cardoons, you know, something that they couldn't find elsewhere. And the farm would agree to grow them. And then the end of the season would come and they would harvest all the cardoons and go. And all of a sudden, the chef wouldn't be at that restaurant anymore. Oh, you know, they had maybe moved on and maybe they didn't need cardoons at their new restaurant. So I knew early on that the way that farms and restaurants work together had changed, because things like that didn't always work out. And it was no one's fault. You know, people changed jobs. Sometimes crops would fail because they couldn't grow a specific thing. Like in their microclimate, broccoli didn't grow well. So kind of had a lot of people taking a lot of unnecessary chances in some of those early partnerships. But what it did was it made people more creative about, and farmers did take, I think, cues from chefs about what to grow. There's a story about Setgraf Farms in the book, which is an amazing story, even as short as it is, about a multi-generational farm that just went through years and years. And I mean, they had their barn, one of their farms burned down. They moved at least once, you know, they transitioned from being a farm that grew crops for grocery stores, you know, because in the 50s and 60s, local grocery stores sourced their fruit and vegetables from local farms. It wasn't until, you know, 60s and 70s when we got this great idea, like, oh, well, we could get all this stuff from California, like year round. Like we could get fruits and vegetables from California and Mexico and ship them across the country. And that ultimately, I mean, that completely changed the market for farms because they lost this huge line of income, which went to the grocery stores. And that's kind of eventually, I think, how they're like, well, how can we sell to people again? You know, what do we do? And so you see the ingenuity as they go through. And Scentgraphs think in their case, you know, they've been around long enough where they went through the really hard times for farms. I mean, there was a point in time when the mom had to go get it. She went and got her real estate license because she's like, we need to make, somebody needs to make some money around here. Mm. And the kids were like, ugh, what do we do? You know, we're old enough now, we can contribute to this. And one of the ideas are, let's focus, why don't we focus on restaurants? And why don't we focus on things like heirloom varieties of things? Because chefs will totally geek out about that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we'll take the rest of the market and see how it does. So they changed their entire model of their farm to be more specialty products, which interestingly enough, didn't really sell well at the farmer's market at first. But eventually, you know, I mean, because people come to the market and they'd be like, what is this? This tomato is all cracky, or right. It's not the, you know, it's not red, you know, it's yellow or pink, or it's got green stripes. What does that taste like? But I think that they also, you know, when farms do things like that, they also change the face of the farmer's market. You know, they made it a far more interesting place for folks to go to get food. I could go on and on. In part because when I started writing this, I mean, I love the idea of making these connections, and the publisher liked the idea. And they're like, you know, people are still really interested in where their food comes from. But I had no idea that when I started to call farmers and talk to them about what they were doing, that they would be so excited to talk to me. I mean, I've never had folks so excited, you know. But they said it, and I heard it over and over again, thank you. And when they said that, they really, really meant it, because they're like, nobody tells our stories. And by about the third interview, I was like, really, nobody tells the farms, the stories of the farms. You know, we all have this idea of how farms work, you know, and there's this movement to kind of get more familiar with where food comes from and to take your kids to farms and learn about how they work. But I realized how little I knew about farms, even though I felt I was pretty well educated in the area, and just how much this meant to all of them, because they really are they're the invisible heroes, you know, behind all of the restaurants and behind all of the, I mean, it was really, really, and it was very, very moving. And I've talked about it a couple of times and told stories, and I get really choked up because I'm like, I now feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to do that for them, you know, to share a little vignette form and just, you know, a little snapshot of what these amazing people, you know, because they all admit, like, this job is hard, but the other thing about it is they all love it for very, very different reasons. And what they get up in the morning, you know, what gets them up in the morning to do is, I don't know, it's remarkable to read. And it really made me feel like, oh my gosh, don't ever look at your job and say, this sucks, you know, look for those things that will keep you getting up in the morning, you know, look for those things that you really, really love, because every job is work, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, that's what, as I was sort of looking through this, and I'm taking my time with it because I want to appreciate each and every one of these farm stories. It's like a book of dreams. I mean, talk about Cream City dreams, right? Like this, every single one you kind of outline, or at least the ones I've read so far, you know, you go through how they started, how the pandemic affected them, of course, but like, you're right. They all wake up in the morning excited to go to work. And that takes a special person. Like I couldn't do that. You know, I know myself well enough to know that that would not be a job for me, but thank God they do this. And you know, like just to see the beauty of what then becomes of what they do in these recipes, of course. But yeah, just there, you know, you put a face to a name, you know? So like I was a part of Rare Earth CSA for a few years a while ago, and I'm going to rejoin this year because now I can see, now I've got the story again, you know, like I appreciate that. So I really hope that our listeners snag a copy of this book. I know there are plenty in Boswell on Downer that you can get a hold of, or I think you can get it anywhere you buy your books, I'm sure.
There is. Yeah. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. I think in Wisconsin for sure. We'll definitely have it in stock. Boswell definitely has a bunch of copies. In fact, they have a bunch of signed copies right now. So
yep.
Oh, cool. if people are fast, they can go grab those up. I will also have some book events that are still coming up. So I had the book launch at Boswell at the beginning of October. I did an event at the West Allis Farmers Market, which was fun. Never done a book where you could do an event at the farmers market, but there are five farms from the book that are at the West Allis Farmers Market. So that was
very cool. Yeah.
But I have a number of events coming up. There's going to be a collaborative chef's dinner with some of the chefs from the book in November. There's a couple
where's that being hosted?
A couple of library events. So it's going to be on November 14th at Alma Linda. And it'll have some local chefs, and then Luke Zahm is coming from Driftless Cafe in Viroqua to do the dinner. He's also in the book. Yeah. So that will be fun. More details will be out there about that. There's some library events. There's a Milwaukee Public Market event coming in November with Valerie Lux from Honey Pie. And she's gonna teach us how to make pie.
Oh my gosh.
She's got a pie recipe and a hand pie recipe in the book.
Awesome.
And so she's gonna come and we'll have some pie to eat.
That's awesome.
So that will be fun. And not everything, as soon as everything, all the details are finalized for all of these, they're going up on my website, which is lauriefrederick.com.
Okay.
So people can easily keep up. They can sign up for my newsletter there too.
Okay.
Because I am sending notices out about the events in the weeks before they happen. So
that's so cool. We will put links to all those in our show notes as well. And then we can put them on our socials when they come out. Because that's exciting. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. And I really do hope that people get a hold of this, because it would be a great book to have on your coffee table all winter, so that when farmers market season, although we do have a farmers market at the table, right?
We
on
do.
Capitol.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We interviewed Venus Williams. She told us all about that. But, you know, for when they really get going in the spring, you'll be ready to go.
But dreaming about it, like heirloom tomatoes and things.
Yes. Like, all winter. Please.
For sure.
Yes,
absolutely. For sure.
Yeah. So this is a fun book, because as I told someone the other day, they're like, well, is this like a book you read or is it a book you cook from? And I said, well, I think it's probably both. You know, if you're like me, I like cookbooks that you can read, because that means I'm going to learn something aside from how to make whatever the recipes are, that I'm going to probably learn something. And if you're not that kind of person, you can just flip through and look at the beautiful pictures, get the story that way, and cook, you know, what looks good to you. So you can be one, the other, or both.
Awesome.
So.
Well, that's a nice little segue into our rapid fire, Shelley, because I actually chose this I'm not trying to earn brownie points here, but I did choose this as my book club book for November. So my
you
first,
did?
I did. Yeah. Because
amazing.
We're a bunch of food also, the women who are in the club. So we're going to do like a Friendsgiving-ish book club where we read the book, talk about the book, but also make some of the recipes in the book. So my first rapid fire question was, do you make book club appearances?
I would. In fact, actually, there's a bookstore in Waterford called Reads by the River, and she does a cookbook club.
Oh, fun.
Which kind of works about the same. Like, people buy the cookbook, they sign up to make recipes, and then they meet, they bring their potluck recipes to a nearby coffee shop. Obviously, to avoid making a mess in the store, but any issues serving food. And they meet and talk about their experience with the recipes, like successes, failures, all the whole nine yards. And so I got invited to come to that.
Oh, fun.
Awesome. And she's like, this is the first time we've had a local author have a cookbook that we were featuring.
Yeah.
So She's like, I'm not sure quite how this will work. But I said, well, I can tell backstories, you know, about the restaurants from the, you know, created the recipes or something.
So fun.
It'll be so fun.
So fun. That's so great. Fun.
Another rapid fire question. If you were commissioned to make a state dish, what would it be?
This is supposed to be rapid.
Does it have cheese curds in it?
Cranberries.
Well, you know, I once wrote a recipe for a Cream City cheeseburger. And I think that we have really, really great burgers in this state. I don't think we talk about it a lot, but I really do think that we have some of the best, and it's probably because we have great farms that supply great things. So yeah, we could have a burger as our state dish.
Maybe we could call it the Cream City Dream Burger.
But
I'm bumching. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get a burp sound effect and like put it in every so often somewhere in this podcast. So that's a one burp.
One burp. Yeah. Anyway.
Is there a restaurant in town that I'm avoiding asking the question, what is your favorite? Because I know you can't, but is there a restaurant you'd go back to again and again and never get tired of it?
There are a number of those. And right now, so I would say I go in streaks. I always say that my dream is to be a regular somewhere because right now I can't, you know, because I really do have to get around, but I can often find excuses to go to places, especially new places, you know, with people around me, like, oh, let's go to dinner. Where should we go? I go in streaks with being what I call obsessed about a place. And one of those places is Birch on Pleasant. And I feel like I could eat that. The menu changes all the time because it's very dependent upon what's new, what's fresh from local farms. And it's interesting because it's actually, the menu changes out a little bit, but there are actually dishes on the menu that just transform themselves based on ingredients. Mm-hmm. So for instance, there's this Conchamar fish recipe, and it's pretty much like a taco concept with a seared fish of some sort, whatever is fresh and great, with house-made tortillas, which sometimes, you know, and sometimes they'll be made with blue corn, sometimes they'll be made with yellow corn, you know, and then accompaniments that are just really fresh and different. So a salsa, and it could be a salsa made from tomatoes or tomatillos or, you know, so it's like the same concept, but entirely different every time you eat it. Like I'm not even sure if I've ever had it the same twice.
Because of the ingredients.
Because the ingredients changed out all the time. So, and I like that because like anybody else, you know, I get stuck on things. You know, there's favorite things that I order, you know, over and over and over again. And I have to remind myself, like, get out of the hole, lady. try something else.
Oh, that's funny.
What about if you could bring a local chef with you to cook for you on a desert island?
Oh, this has so much to do with not only the food, but who I could tolerate for that long. Let me see. Oh, this is so hard. I think I'd want to bring somebody like Nell Benton, who used to own the National Cafe. And I'm explicitly picking a woman because I think if I had to be stuck on an island, I don't know, women have a lot of ingenuity, you know, if we're going to have to survive this, you know, we may not have the brawn, you know, but we'll figure out how to make it work. And she would be great company, and she has lived all over the world. And so she'd probably be really creative with whatever ingredients we had at our disposal.
Yeah. Awesome. Nell's a good friend of mine. I just had lunch with her this week and she was telling me how she's like building houses and putting in windows. So she would also be like, not only your chef, but like she would be a jackaline of all trades. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that she's kind of gotten out of the industry, so to speak,
she's incredible. If you were having a party and you were going to have a food truck cater your party, who would you choose?
There is an Italian food truck that's fairly new to the scene called Naughty Plates. And like literally pronounced, it's N-A-D-I, but pronounced kind of like naughty. Naughty Plates. It's just like they do pizzas and pastas and a really good job. They make things that you wouldn't expect to come out of a food truck. And they have a catering menu that goes way beyond what they have in the food truck.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like that would be among my choices. It would have been, you know, do you ask that question 6 months ago? It would have been Heirloom. But now they have their own restaurants.
Yeah.
And they lost their truck to a fire before the restaurant opened. I think they plan to get another truck because I think that's a nice piece of side income for any.
They're in the new or the old Lazy Susan. Is that right? In Bayview? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But they were always, I mean, they impressed me so much because, I mean, I'd heard stories about food trucks, primarily on the West Coast that can operate all year, that operated more like restaurants, more like fine dining restaurants, you know, with like fussy little dishes. And while Heirloom was never super fussy, they were serving steamed mussels, you know, and hand-pulled burrata off of this truck. And I was like, this is my kind of food truck. You know, it's not all just, you know, because you think of food trucks here and it's like, well, it's burgers or it's tacos or it's, and all of the things are great, but not things that you necessarily want to eat every meal, you know, every day.
Right. Yeah. So. We are spoiled in Milwaukee. I think people don't always realize that, but we have such an incredible food scene here.
Incredible food scene and a really good food truck scene for not being the warmest of climates, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we are very lucky here. Yeah.
Is there a, you mentioned earlier that you liked finding the hidden gems. So is there a hidden gem in Milwaukee that still is hidden, that's been around a long time in terms of food?
There are. And I think.
She doesn't want to tell us.
I know.
No, I totally do. Okay. So there are some places, I think, places stay hidden in some ways for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I could probably mention any restaurants and there will be, you know, a whole cadre of people who've never been, because we all have this tendency to go to our favorite places. You know, part of why I came up, I have this list called 52 restaurants, and it's a restaurant a week for a whole year, technically, if you want to follow along that way, because I'm like, we're all in ruts, right? Like we go to our five places, we order the same things. So I could probably come up with, you know, a bunch of, you know, places that are, you know, that are hidden, but there is the best carnitas that I've ever had in my life. We're at a little restaurant on the south side called Carnitas Machete. And they're literally only open on Saturdays and Sundays. Wow. They're generally sold out by noon. And they have other things that they have other things on their menu that they serve. But if you want the carnitas, which are made in the traditional way, I have been told that the story behind the restaurant is that the owner, part of why they only are operating on weekends, is the owner works at a farm in central Wisconsin during the week and potentially is able to trade for a pig that he can then bring home.
Wow.
For carnitas on the weekend. And this place has little like amazing little group of like Mexican grandmothers in the back who are making corn tortillas that, I kid you not, are as big as a dinner plate.
Wow.
And there's things like on the menu. There are other great things. There's like a goat consomme, which has like big chunks of meat in it that you could wrap in your tortillas and like eat kind of like a birria sort of a concept. I don't know. Just life-changing. And I think it's a hidden gem in part because it's scarce. You know, it's 2 days a week. You have to go, you know, eat your carnitas on Saturday or Sunday morning.
Right.
Or they do sell meat by the pound. So you could come in, grab your meat, maybe some tortillas, and be on your way. That's probably the way that I would do it more regularly. And I had the fortune of being introduced to this place by Jesus Gonzalez, who owns Mazurka Taco Truck at Sokola Food Park. And he said, yeah, there's this place you have to experience. Cool. And it helps if you know a little Spanish. Like you probably get a better seat in the dining room, you know, if you can navigate your way around that way.
Yeah.
But very truly awesome. Like amazing. So.
Excellent.
Awesome. Oh,
nice. Nice. Well, I want to be mindful of your time, and we haven't even dove into the, you're a podcaster as well. You have your own podcast with Unmilwaukee called Food Crush. So that is out there. And we've had some overlapping guests. We had Liv Menzia of Live a Little Ice Cream. We've had Emerald Mills from Turning Tables. Yes. We've had Caitlin Cullen of the Tandem Now Kinship. But I'm wondering, our last question for you would be, is there a woman in Milwaukee that you see as living her dream? Maybe it's somebody that everybody knows, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's somebody just in your own personal sphere who would be a good person for us. Yeah.
I do, actually. There's a friend of mine, well, who I got to know because of my blogger. She was a food blogger. Mm. And her name is Maggie Jews. I can send you her contact information. Oh, she owns a business called Real Good Life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like a home delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Food delivery business, which she created to kind of help women, like to empower women that they do not have to be a slave to the stove every day. And I left because when I met her, she was working, she did some work with like a nonprofit. Ugh, I was always confused about her job. You can ask her about that. But she always had aspirations to like be Martha Stewart. And I laugh, but she would say that with the most sincerity, that she wanted kind of this empire, like she wanted to write a book and she wanted to have a food something. And, you know, and I'll be really honest, launching this business and the success that she is, I think they just celebrated 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the success that she's had has been really, really impressive because, you know, there's a lot of food. There's a lot of options now for food delivery or you know, meal delivery services. And she's somehow made hers really stand out. And part of it is, you know, she has partnered with restaurants. There's a lot of personality behind it. Definitely. And definitely, I think she would say like her dream continues, right? Like,
yeah, so, I wrote briefly with her. We were bloggers at Milwaukee Mom's blog for a while years ago. Mm-hmm. So I know her tangentially, but yeah. And I've had her food too when I was, after the babies were born, we certainly had weeks of the Real Good Life food delivered to us. So thank you. Yeah, that's a great
nominee. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. This has been such a dreamy conversation.
so much fun always. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we will post links to all your events that are coming up, links to how people can get a hold of this cookbook, how they can listen to you on Food Crush, and links to On Milwaukee as well, where you are a writer.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I just love all these stories, Shelley.
Yeah.
Such a fun interview.
Really, really cool. And just thinking about how our food landscape has shifted dramatically over the last 50, 60 years and how it will continue to shift, hopefully, as more and more people recognize the importance of eating local, you know, supporting local farmers.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's so much better too, man. This summer I had the privilege of going to a pretty regular Sunday dinner that was made from all farmers market stuff, and everything. And you know, like it doesn't take a lot to make fresh food taste good, right? It's just so much better.
Yeah,
when it's fresh.
And the recipes in this book look incredible. I can't wait to try them out. But you know, the other thing that I loved about her story as a dreamer is in both instances that we talked about, both in her career as a food writer at On Milwaukee and when it came time to think about writing this book, she really stopped and said, hang on a minute, before we just dive into what you think I maybe should do, let me just pause and think about what I want this to be. You know, and I love how I love that story about how she took the time to really consider not only what she wanted for herself, you know, for her own dream, but also like what would be best for everyone else. How could she best serve, you know, the community in writing this book and in writing about restaurants and, you know, food related things for On Milwaukee. It's like the way she talked about being a critic. Like, she's not a critic. She, there's enough of those, you know? Right. And Lord knows we do have enough critics, right?
Yep. That's, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I just love that part of the story that she took the time, because I think that's something that we can all do in terms of just self-reflection, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then also just her own story about looking for windows and doors wherever she went, how long it took her to get to the place of writing about food, and wasn't something she ever dreamed about as a job, right? But she was doing it.
Yeah.
And then the doors and windows of getting people together and getting curious about who the other food bloggers were, having events, you know, it's just kind of a fun reflection on how dreams come alive, right? By looking for those doors and windows and opening them, climbing through.
And how no experience is wasted, like, right? Back from episode or season one, right? One of the lessons that we took from all of our guests is that no experience is wasted. So she's writing a food blog back in 97 or whenever that was, with no pictures, and just, you know, just each little thing is a step on the ladder to, you know, and who knows where she's at now, what is yet to come. Great things, right. No doubt. So.
Absolutely. Well, it's time for lunch.
It is time for lunch. We'll put a link to all the ways you can meet Lori in the wild in our show notes. So be sure to tune in there or check those out.
And you might have to choose between our guest or us to see in the wild this November, because November 14th, the night of Lori's event. Where is that at?
Amelinda. Oh. Dang it. I love Amelinda too.
I know. We will be at Alverno College.
We will be at Alverno College.
With She Stands Tall. And we'd love to see you out in the crowd, y'all. We have the privilege of just imagining you, our listeners. But on November 14th, we'll get to hopefully look out in the crowd and see you as we record the podcast. So,
and chat with Stephanie Melnick of Melnick & Melnick. So, yeah, we would love to see you. Bring your questions for us. The tables are turned. We hope to see you there. And otherwise, stay tuned for next week's episode, where we interview another Milwaukee woman living her dream
in the Cream City. Until then, keep on dreaming.
Keep on dreaming. Okay, Milwaukee, guess what?
We are spending more money than we have earned via our podcast by getting new music and buying swag. Can you help us out?
This is a labor of love, listeners. We do this because we love it. And we also love coffee.
We do love coffee. And actually, we don't really use the coffee money for coffee, but it's easier to ask for coffee than it is to ask for money. So, will you give us coffee?
Would you buy us a cup? If you like our podcast, click the link in our show notes.
Or share this with other people.
We love that too.
Especially rich uncles. Or aunts. I should really stop saying rich uncles. Rich aunts, baby. That's who we want supporting the pod.
I mean, uncles are okay too. We also love reviews. So leave us a review. If you like the podcast, if you love these women, share it. Like us, leave us a review.
What's your coffee order, Megan?
Half calf, please. I've had too much already.
I had a new one that I'm obsessed with, a Shakerado, which I totally thought was a McDonald's drive-thru order. It's apparently like a fancy Italian shaken espresso with sugar, and it's amazing.
Wow.
I had it at Vendetta Coffee Bar. So if anybody wants to buy me one of those or 10, I'm in.
Boom. Haven't dropped a boom in a while.
Oh, I have some fiber for that. I entertain us.
Okay, friends, and that's a wrap.